Lecture 12, Renaissance Art.
Well, one of the greatest contributions of Renaissance culture, of course, was art, painting, architecture, sculpture. So in this lecture, we're going to take a brief look at the Renaissance period of art, because it really is one of the greatest periods of art in the whole history of Western art, and introduces a new and distinctive style to art that really makes it unique and characteristic of the Renaissance period. We're going to see changing patronage patterns. We're going to actually see a very important change in artistic styles. We're going to see different motivations for the art. And this will all end in the production of some of the greatest artistic masterpieces of all time. And what I would like to argue in the beginning of the lecture here is that most of these important changes that we see in art can be tied to broader cultural, social developments in the Renaissance itself. So it's really of a piece with most of the other things we've been looking at in the Renaissance so far. We'll begin with patronage patterns, because this really is something that influenced the development of Renaissance art a great deal. In the Middle Ages, the main patron for art had been the church. And the church was a good patron for art, and it paid for quite a lot of art. But the church often had a very distinct idea of not only what it wanted painted or created in terms of art, but how it wanted it done, the style it wanted it done in. And this tended to create a kind of unified style among all the creators of these artistic pieces that perhaps inhibited individualism. In the Renaissance, however, we start to see different patronage patterns. The church, of course, is still an important patron. But now, lay people, princes, patricians, as well as merchants, and even lower down in the middle class, are important patrons of art. They buy a lot of art. And they generally don't tell the artist how to paint things. And often they don't even tell the artist what to paint. Sometimes they do, but normally not, and they almost never get involved in the style of the painting. So this tended to free up artists to express more of their own individual styles and develop more of their own individual styles, without having the church kind of requiring certain things. Another important thing is that the Renaissance is a period of increasing wealth in lay society. We've already seen that with the plague and the demographic collapse, that the population was reduced, but the number of people that were left were really more wealthy because they had inherited the money of the family members who were deceased. And so these people tend to buy a lot of art because they have a good deal of money to spend. And so the demand for art goes up. We've also seen that in the 14th, 15th century, during the period of the economic depression, that art was considered a good investment. It was stable, gains in value all the time, safe, and for that reason, it was a very popular investment in the depressed economy, and that also increased the demand for artwork. And we're not talking just about paintings, but we're talking about the building of chapels and the creation of sculpture and all sorts of things that we'll take a look at during the lecture. So art is a good investment, but art also being freed up to express more of an individual style on the part of the artists. That's certainly one really important factor. But another important factor in the distinctive Renaissance style of art that evolves, I would like to argue, comes from religious changes that we haven't talked a lot about yet in the course, but I want to just touch on briefly here. During the 14th century, when the church had been in such a crisis with the Babylonian captivity and the schism, the church had really lost a lot of its ability to be a spiritual leader of the people. And at a time when there was the plague and the Hundred Years' War and famine and all that, and when people really needed the guidance and comfort of the church, the spiritual comfort of the church, it was so involved in its own problems, it really didn't have the opportunity to provide the comfort and guidance and leadership that the people needed. And for this reason, in a kind of miraculous fashion, common people began to develop their own distinctive religious practices. This was known as the development of popular piety. They developed their own religious practices, which usually involved actively doing something and was always very emotionally oriented, because this is what people were, you know, interested in, active involvement in the religion so they could feel closer to God and safer, and a very emotional involvement. So popular piety was a religion of great emotion. Just to give you one example, in the Middle Ages when people went to Mass, they would just go in the church and stand in the nave, there were no pews, listen to the Mass. Oftentimes, and it's always in Latin, and they don't really understand Latin, so they don't know what's going on, then they leave. Not a very fulfilling religious experience. Part of popular piety was the development of the rosary necklace, where while you're standing there listening to this Mass in Latin, which you don't really understand, you can say prayers to the Virgin and count the prayers on these beads by moving them across on the chain and feel like you're actually speaking to God and getting closer to heaven that way. So it's an active, involved, emotional kind of religion. Another example, Stations of the Cross were invented during this period. Pilgrimages became very popular. So popular piety was people taking religion into their own hands and creating a religion of great emotion and great activity that they could be involved in. And what I would argue is that this religion, this popular religion of emotion, really influenced in a big way the Renaissance style of art. Because these same people, a lot of these same people who are involved in popular piety are buying the art. And they want to see their religious feelings, point of view, perspective, reflected in the art. Another real important fact that feeds into this is the humanist belief in rhetoric. We've already looked at the fact that humanists believed that rhetoric was incredibly important. Eloquence was incredibly important to inspire and motivate the will of people, to get people to live a good life and make good decisions and be good citizens. And I think this also, this humanistic influence had an impact on the distinctive Renaissance style of art, because you could almost say that Renaissance art becomes a kind of visual rhetoric. It tries to do some of the same things in pictures and images and forms that humanists were trying to do through rhetoric and eloquence and beautiful Latin and, you know, great communications. Well, what do I mean by that? For example, and this is a very important example, painters, first of all, then other artists, begin to manipulate elements of painting, like shape, or line, or color. And they do this to get the eye of the viewer to go to a certain place in the painting as soon as the viewer looks at the painting. So what the artist is trying to do is get you, if you're looking at a painting, when you first see it, to focus on a really important point in the painting. And they use shape, line, and color to lead your vision to that point. Well, what kind of point are they trying to lead you to? Usually, it tends to be the point of most emotion in the painting. Most of these paintings, even though they're done for lay people, are still on religious topics. And so it would be the point of most emotion in a religious scene. And the point of this visual rhetoric in painting and later in other forms of art, is to get the viewer emotionally involved in the religious scene that's being portrayed. By focusing your view, for example, on a face with definite emotions on it, or another point of great emotion, it'll get you involved, you'll experience the religious scene that's there, and perhaps it will inspire you to piety. You know, and I think that really goes along with the humanist belief in rhetoric and also popular piety's belief in a kind of emotional religion. Well, the pioneer of this Renaissance style is a painter who actually lived and worked very early, Giotto, who lived from 1266 to 1336, years usually thought to be before the Renaissance, but Giotto is considered to be, you know, the pioneer of this particular Renaissance style of painting. And he made a number of important early pioneering contributions. He kicks off what I call the early Renaissance period in art, where a lot of the techniques are pioneered and developed and tried by artists, and to a great extent perfected. But in the later High Renaissance, you find tremendous geniuses coming along who use these techniques already tried and pioneered, and you know, carry them even to a higher level. Well, what did Giotto do? One of the things he did was he painted Madonnas. The Madonna you're going to see portrayed is the Madonna enthroned. And his contribution there is he painted these Madonnas as real people with emotions. In the Middle Ages, they'd always been painted as saints or godlike figures with really no emotion on their faces. But the effort here was to get across the message that Mary was a woman, a real person. She suffered, she had emotions. You can identify with that when you see her emotions. So he wanted to get across the idea that these Madonnas were not God-like. I mean, in a way, they were divine, but they were also was a very human figure that people could identify with and feel the same emotions and feel close to and feel involved with. You know, and in a certain sense, when you feel that way, you feel protected by the religion, when you feel a part of such an important icon of the religion. Giotto also did a whole series of paintings on the life of St. Francis. You'll see portrayed here the death of St. Francis. And again, the effort is to portray St. Francis as a person with great emotional expression on his part and on the part of other people in the paintings. So people, again, could identify with it, feel a part of the scene, feel like they understood what was going on, and feel, you know, closer to the religion that way. Giotto did as well a series of paintings on the life of Christ. And here you see the baptism of Christ portrayed. And again, these focus on emotions. Now, Christ being half God, half man, you can't portray as just a simple mortal. But he attempted to show that Christ was a person with love and compassion and emotions that other people could identify with and understand and feel a part of. And this is a very different style from medieval religious painting. You could call it a secular style, but the object's not secular. It's not to say, well, you know, Mary was really a person, or St. Francis was really a person. The point of it is to get the viewer emotionally involved in the religious scene, experience that's being portrayed. Giotto's masterpiece was called The Lamentation, and that's in the Arena Chapel in Padua. You see that also portrayed. This shows the love and the anguish of Mary and the disciples after they've taken Christ down from the cross and he's dead and they're experiencing his death. And in this painting, you see people experiencing death in a way that people experience death with sadness, with a kind of love, but, you know, anguish about the whole thing. And it really comes through in this important piece of work. Well, Giotto just kicked off these trends. Many people came along to continue them. And in architecture, one of the important early pioneers was Brunelleschi, who lived from 1377 to 1446. He made a really interesting contribution because he decided to, he looked at Giotto's paintings and he said, what I want to do is use Giotto's methods, but I want to do it in architecture. And the way he would do it, for example, when he designed a church as an architect, he would use line, the architectural lines of the building, the inside of the building, so that when a person entered the church, their eyes would follow these architectural lines and automatically focus on the altar. And you see a picture of one of his churches depicted here. The altar being the point of greatest emotion in the church. That's where the sacrifice of the Mass occurs. And so that's what you should think about when you go into a church. Christ's sacrifice, the Mass. And Giotto Brunelleschi is getting people to focus their attention on that when they first go in. Brunelleschi also, in a more humanistic kind of fashion, revived the Roman classical style of architecture. And perhaps he's most famous for the fact that he built the domed roof on the top of the Florentine Cathedral. Now, this was a real important contribution because the Florentines had built this cathedral, and the central part was an octagonon, and they hadn't really figured out what kind of roof to put on it. And somebody said, well, it should be a dome. And, you know, that dome would work perfectly on this octagonal shape. But nobody had designed and built a dome since antiquity, and no one knew how to do it. Brunelleschi volunteered to do it. He went to Rome. He studied Roman ruins there. Particularly, he studied the Pantheon, which has a Roman dome on it. He measured it, and he basically figured out how to build a dome again. He comes back to Florence. He builds the cathedral dome, which you see depicted here. It becomes known as Brunelleschi's Dome, the first dome built since antiquity, and it makes the dome a kind of characteristic part of Renaissance architecture. Brunelleschi also pioneered other aspects of Roman architecture, for example, the classical straight lines, the rounded arch, which you see in buildings he designed, such as the Pitti Palace. Continuing on in painting, Masaccio continued the work of both Giotto and Brunelleschi. Masaccio, and you see pictured here his resurrection of Theophilus's son, he studied Brunelleschi's use of lines of perspective, how you can use these perspective lines to focus people's view in architectural case on the altar of a church. And Masaccio decided he would use these lines of perspective to create three-dimensional depth perspective in painting. So he was really the pioneer of three-dimensional depth perspective in painting. At first, he painted his figures inside architectural frameworks so he could use the actual architectural lines used by Brunelleschi. Later on, he uses a grid and he abandons the architectural frameworks. He creates the illusion of depth, three-dimensional space on a flat surface, perhaps partly for the purposes of realism, but also because the depth perspective also guides the viewer's eye to certain points in the painting that the painter wants you to look at first, which is going to be the point of most emotion. Fra Filippo Lippi, another early Renaissance painter, lived from 1406 to 1469, painted Madonnas, like this Madonna and Child that you see here, as real women with emotions, very much like Giotto had, but even more so. And so he continues that tradition. Piero della Francesca, another early Renaissance painter, lived from 1416 to 1492, develops three-dimensional depth perspective. Here you see a picture of his Death of Adam. He really concentrates on three-dimensional depth perspective. He even wrote a book on it about how to do it. And again, it was to manipulate people's eyes and lead them to a certain point in the painting, which usually was a point of great emotion or spirituality for Piero della Francesca. So he further develops that trend. The father of the Renaissance style of sculpture was Lorenzo Ghiberti. He won a contest in Florence to construct the doors of the baptistry building, which he named the Gates of Paradise, and you see a picture of that here. There he used line to simulate a kind of rhythmic motion and made the sculpted panels of these doors seem to actually move before your eyes and come alive. And that would, again, involve people in the scenes and get people to identify with it. And it was also, to some extent, more realistic. But perhaps the best early Renaissance sculptor was Donatello, who lived from 1386 to 1466. He trained with such famous people as Ghiberti. He went with Brunelleschi to Rome, and when Brunelleschi was up measuring the dome, Donatello was studying Roman sculpture and how to do that. And when he came back, he revived the classical Roman style of sculpture, which you see here in his bronze David, a style based on realism and admiration for the human form, which had been characteristic of classical architecture. The bronze David that you see here was the first Renaissance nude that was done, and that was considered a little bit shocking at the time. But the greatest universal genius of the early Renaissance has to be Leon Battista Alberti, who lived from 1404 to 1472. He was not just an artist, a painter. He was an architect. He was a man of letters, a scholar, and even a brilliant theoretician of art. Born in Florence to a family rich from the woolen cloth trade, he did amazing things at an early age. At the age of 20, he wrote a Latin play in the classical style, became a brilliant organist, invented a machine to raise sunken ships, and went to Rome to study art and architecture. As an architect, and he made contributions in all these areas, as an architect, you see one of his buildings here, the Rucellai Palace, he built in the classical style, meaning straight lines, rounded arches, just as the Romans had done it. As a humanist, he wrote a book on architecture, which was modeled on the classical Roman architectural treatise of Vitruvius, and it became one of the standard books on architecture in the Renaissance period. He also wrote another book in 1435 called On Painting, which was the first really scientific treatise on painting done in the Renaissance. It analyzed specifically proportion, spectrum, color use, and attempted to tell people how to use these things. And in fact, his theories were much used later on by such famous artists as Piero della Francesca and Raphael. Finally, Alberti wrote a book called On the Family in 1443, which was the first book on home economics ever written. So quite a contribution there. Now we come to the period of the High Renaissance, a period I basically date from about 1450 to 1550. This is a period in which Renaissance art reaches its zenith, and the techniques pioneered earlier are, I guess you could say mastered, but I would just say further developed and brought to an even higher point by some of the most impressive geniuses of this period. You might say dominating geniuses. One of whom, and one of the most famous of whom, was Leonardo da Vinci, who lived from 1452 to 1519. Da Vinci, as most people know, was not just a painter, but also an architect, an engineer, a sculptor, and made other contributions as well. Interestingly enough, only 15 of his paintings actually survive today, but all of these are among the greatest paintings, the greatest masterpieces of all time. His greatest skill in painting, or actually in a lot of the art he did, was in portraying human psychology and emotion in his subjects. And here again, you can see the tie-in to popular piety. He's often portraying religious topics, but he wants to portray them in a way that people can identify with, people can understand the emotion that's involved with the scene. People can say, well, yes, I felt these things myself. I know what's going on in this scene. They can feel a part of it. And Leonardo was really sensitive to drawing people in like that. One of his most famous works, of course, is The Last Supper, which he painted in Milan on the refectory wall. And this portrays the moment at which Christ tells his apostles at the Last Supper that he's going to be betrayed. And what it does, if you look around that table and look at the faces of the people at the table, each one has a slightly different emotional reaction to this shocking news. You know, disbelief, sadness, different kinds of reactions that ordinary people would have if someone had told them a thing like this. How can you know? Why would somebody do a terrible thing like this? And it really draws you into the scene. It's almost as if you were sitting there at the table with them, and you heard it, and you watched them all react. Kind of a moment frozen in time, but in other ways, a very dynamic scene where there actually, when you look at the different faces, and there are many different thoughts and emotions being felt and expressed and experienced. You know, it's a whole panoply of human reaction to this kind of extremely important event in Christian history. And, you know, it should be pointed out that all these artists, don't just paint religious scenes because someone says, I want you to paint me a painting of Christ or Adam or whatever else. They're very Christian and pious people themselves, and they have the intent to try to motivate people to piety, to draw people into the religion. They want to make people feel safe with God. They want to make people feel a part of the religion. And so, you know, they themselves, the artists themselves, are as involved in these scenes they're painting as they want the people to be, the viewers to be. And that's why they use these different means to manipulate the viewer's vision, to manipulate the viewer's reaction to the paintings, to manipulate the viewer's emotions even, to draw them in and get them involved. Of course, Da Vinci made many other contributions. As a scientist, and he was a great scientist, he had tremendous botanical knowledge, for example. And when he paints paintings, when he includes plants, trees, flowers in paintings, they're real plants, trees, and flowers. You can identify them because, you know, he observed nature and he painted nature just as it really was. He didn't just paint generic bushes and trees. He painted the real thing because he had the botanical knowledge to do that. As an inventor, and he was also a great inventor, he had left behind notebooks with sketches of inventions that would be realized in the distant future, things like helicopters, airplanes, tanks, submarines. It's kind of interesting that he never really attempted to build almost any of these inventions. He built a few, but not very many. It's even more interesting because he was employed by the Sforza in Milan as a military engineer. And presumably he made a number of these sketches as suggestions for things that could be used, like a tank. It was like a conical kind of thing that people would get in. It was armored. They would ride in it. They would fire from it. And so it's kind of curious to notice that none of these inventions were ever built and utilized, where I'm sure Sforza was paying good money to have them thought about, designed out, and so forth. Da Vinci worked for a number of very important Renaissance people. He worked for Ludovico Sforza in Milan, both as painter and engineer. He worked for Lorenzo the Magnificent in Florence. He had tremendous influence in Renaissance art and culture. His masterpiece, which everybody's aware of, I'm sure, is the Mona Lisa, which is, of course, famous for the fact that her face portrays a very definite kind of emotion that people have ever since speculated about. You know, what exactly is she thinking and saying with this particular facial expression? He painted this picture in Florence. It was appreciated at the time. It was purchased by the King of France, Francis I, for the greatest price ever paid for a painting, taken to Paris and put in the Royal Palace. Of course, it now hangs in the Louvre, which used to be the Royal Palace. Raphael of Urbino, another late Renaissance genius, painted Madonnas like the Madonna of the Goldfinch you see here with great serenity and great emotion in their faces. And he also used perspective and geographic form to great advantage in getting people to focus on the points of emotion that he wanted to concentrate on. And finally, there was Michelangelo Buonarroti, 1475 to 1564, another one of those universal geniuses that most humanists would have loved to think they created because it was all part of their educational vision to create these many-sided people. He was a genius in painting, in architecture, in sculpture, in many other areas. It's hard to sum up, you know, exactly what the most important aspects of his artistic works were, but at least one of them was his knack of portraying his subjects at the moment of a kind of psychological transition, where they just thought of something, and the thought was really represented on their face with their facial expression, and you can almost tell what they're thinking by the expression on their face. Probably his most famous sculpture is the one that you see here on the screen, the Marble David, which is in Florence. That, we think, was meant to represent David just as he's decided to throw the rock at Goliath and while he's thinking of what possibly could happen. But, of course, the masterpiece was the Sistine Chapel, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's greatest contribution, considered often a masterpiece of Neoplatonic symbolism, recently cleaned and restored, and certainly one of the most important pieces of Renaissance art by any of these geniuses.